that prevent the delivery of U.S.-backed aid. And I wanted to bring that to the end of your piece, where you quote a Lebanese friend who's been living in the U.S. for a while, saying, I'm either in the flames or I'm in the place that's lighting the fire. Can you talk about the U.S. role in what's happening in your country, Lebanon, and Gaza?
I mean, the United States is, you know, there's always these debates about who is wagging the dog, let's say, you know, this idea of like who is truly in control. Is it Israel or is it the United States? For me, they are one and the same. Israel seems to be kind of like a colonial outpost of the United States, and I feel that their interests are very much aligned. And so the United States continues to say that it is not interested in a regional war. It is not interested in a conflagration. At the same time, they have been running cover for what Israel has been doing in Gaza for an entire year. And honestly, since pretty much October 8th, we could see that this day was coming. We could see that so long as the war continued in Gaza, as long as the assault on Gaza continued, that this was eventually going to come and engulf Lebanon. And, you know, once Lebanon goes up in flames, it's also very likely that the entire region goes up in flames. And so the United States can say all they like that they are, you know, looking at the possibility of a ceasefire, that they don't want for there to be a regional war. But the way that they have been doing things is, you know, frankly says otherwise, including and up to the fact that every single time that, you know, there's something that Israel needs to be called out on, we see them running interference for Israel. You know, all the State Department spokespeople refuse to comment. They will not allow journalists to ask them any questions, and they will deflect constantly. And so, I mean, the United States is firmly partnered, you know, as they keep saying, they say, you know, we're looking to our partners in Israel. That's exactly what they mean. They're partners in Israel. They are partners in crime. And they truly are one in the same. It's very difficult, honestly, to separate between the two, the United States and Israel at this point.
And Lina, I wanted to ask you about the timing of this escalation by the Netanyahu government, because those of us who have followed the conflict in the Middle East for decades know that Israel almost always uses the period before a presidential election or sometimes after the election, before a new government is sworn in, to launch its fiercest attacks, precisely because it knows that the administration in power, given the volatility of U.S. elections, is reluctant to take any action to even mildly criticize Israel. Wondering what your thoughts about the timing of this escalation.
I mean, I think you're absolutely correct. And yet at the same time, because we have seen absolutely no change in the U.S. administration, the Biden administration has been absolutely gung-ho, 100% behind Israel. You know, so they have the full support. So it's not, it doesn't seem to me like this is going to, that the United States is at any point was even threatening to withdraw full support from what's happening. So yes, the timing is before the election. And at the same time, you know, it's been going on for so long at this point that I don't even know what the election has to do with it anymore. It's just, it feels like the United States is busy right now with its own, with the elections and what's happening there, and Israel is just free to run rampage, you know, all over Gaza, all over Lebanon. So it is related to the United States elections, and yet at the same time, I really cannot see how it's going to make any difference whether it's Harris or Trump or Biden in power, frankly, at this stage. It seems like it's just running on autopilot, this war, at this point.
Lina Munzad, I want to thank you so much for being with us. Lebanese writer, translator, senior editor of the arts and literature magazine, The Markaz Review. We'll link to your piece in Middle East Eye, headlined Israel's war on Lebanon, the trauma of watching the Hollywood movie from afar. Next up, Climate Week is underway here in New York. 31 activists were arrested trying to shut down Citibank headquarters yesterday. Democracy Now! Was there. We'll also speak with Kumi Naidoo, former head of Greenpeace and Amnesty, now president of the Fossil Fuel Non-Proliferation Treaty Initiative, in from South Africa. Stay with us. The One Going Towards My Land by Ahmed Kaboord. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. We turn to Climate Week, which has brought thousands of government leaders, scientists, companies and activists to New York City alongside the United Nations General Assembly. Activists began the week Monday with a direct action shutting down one of the world's largest funders of fossil fuel expansion. Democracy Now! Was outside Citibank's global headquarters in Manhattan when 31 activists were arrested for blocking the building's entrance after the company ignored their repeated requests for a meeting. Many spoke about the devastating impacts of Citibank's fossil fuel investments on their communities in states like Louisiana and Texas.
Hey, city, get off it. The planet over profit. Hey, city, get off it. The planet over profit. Hey, city, get off it. The planet over profit.
Stay in front. Stay in front. Jonathan Weston with Climate Defenders. Cities financing the entire destruction of the Gulf South, and families from the Gulf South came up here to meet with them today, and city refused to meet with them.
My name is Melanie. I work for Strong Economy for All here in New York. We are here to shut it down during Climate Week because we know a better future is possible. We do not need to be investing in fossil fuels. The time is now for renewable energy, and we are demanding Citibank hear us.
Are you willing to get arrested for them?
Yes, I am willing to get arrested today because I believe in a better future than what Citibank is financing every single day.
Hey, Cheryl Barnes, I'm definitely willing to be arrested. Citibank refuses to meet with us. They are responsible for ecocide and genocide all over the world.
You may be charged with additional crimes since you have refused.
Please welcome Bill McKibben.
This is towards the end of this remarkable summer of heat. More than 1,000 of us have gone to jail so far this summer. And the reason is because this building behind us, this is the headquarters of the largest funder of fossil fuel expansion on planet Earth. If there is a flood near you, if there is a fire near you, if you can't grow food anymore where you used to, if you're having to leave your home because the ocean is rising, if you're living through some heat wave where the temperature is going to 120 degrees, this building is a big reason why.
My name is Camille Oze, and I'm traveling here from Southwest Louisiana. I have to come all the way out here just to fight for clean air in my communities. Every day, I have to pass by plant industries that give me really bad headaches and that smell really bad. I don't want to have to do that. I'm only in middle school. I shouldn't have to worry about what my plant is going to look like tomorrow or in 35 years. Where I live, After every hurricane, we can't drink the water because the water's contaminated. Every time we go fishing, we have to throw the fish back because the fish and the water are contaminated. The city banks keep funding these fossil fuel industries in our communities. They put them in the small black and indigenous communities on purpose because they know that we can't do anything about that. They put them in poor communities and low-income communities on purpose. This is not okay. This is racist. I'm not even a teenager yet, and I have to fight for my life and many others my age. I shouldn't have to do this. This is not right.
We will continue.
We will continue.
To shut down this building.
To shut down this building.
Until Citibank.
Until Citibank.
Stops funding fossil fuels.
Stops funding fossil fuels.
Please welcome Jerry, who came all the way from the Philippines.
I came here for the climate week. After five storms that have devastated my country. Since a heat wave in summer. That has devastated 120 provinces and cities in my country. With 120 Fahrenheit degrees. Which we haven't experienced historically. This is what city is doing to all of us.
My name is Kazi Fauzia. Recent time you see the flooding in Bangladesh. 200,000 people are displaced from their home. This is the corporation responsible for the climate disaster. They invest everything to disaster. They invest destroy our land, our home.
My name is Sue Page. I'm from Surfside Beach, Texas. I'm with Better Brazoria. We are on the Gulf Coast of Texas. I'm standing in front of Citibank because there is a company that they help to finance called Enterprise. And what happens is they are going to build one pipeline through a seaport oil terminal. There's actually two pipelines proposed going through my area. So we will be able to shut it down if Citibank would stop funding this endeavor.
Some of the voices from Monday's Citibank protests that kicked off Climate Week here in New York City alongside the UN General Assembly. Today, President Biden is addressing the UN General Assembly and will be speaking at another event about his climate accomplishments. For more, we're joined by Kumi Naidu, longtime South African human rights and environmental justice activist, former head of Greenpeace International, also former head of Amnesty International, now the president of the Fossil Fuel Non-Proliferation Treaty Initiative. Can you lay out what this Fossil Fuel Non-Proliferation Treaty is all about and what you're doing, Kumi?
So the first time I met you, Amy, was at the Copenhagen Climate Summit in 2009, where you'll remember we were calling for a fab deal, not a fabulous deal, but a fair, ambitious and binding deal in 2009. What we got was a flab deal full of loopholes and BS. And what we have seen is, important though the COP is to get us in the right direction, that when you have the kind of domination by fossil fuel lobbyists and so on in the COP, where they've managed to somehow keep the term fossil fuels off any COP declaration and so on, we have to now recognize that we need something complementary. And I think the effort made by Sipora Berman, the founder of the treaty, and the wonderful team that she's assembled is exactly what we need, which is we need to have a legal instrument that ensures that governments can comply. Right now, it's sort of voluntary. right? They can agree things in COP and they can walk away on it the next day. So we are starting a process. There's already 13 countries on board. The exciting thing is already Colombia and Timor-Leste, two fossil fuel exporting countries, are already on board. And we feel quite confident that as more and more extreme weather events happen on a day-to-day basis virtually around the world, that citizens are rising in a way that we will push our leaders to actually come together and get a global agreement to phase out completely and eradicate fossil fuels from our economic system.
And Kumi, you mentioned Colombia. Could you talk about what is going on in terms of movements in Latin America, the Colombia becoming the first nation to join the coalition?
So what we are seeing is that the most vulnerable countries in the world and those that are in the front line of climate impacts are the ones that actually are the first movers. And basically, once we have a critical mass, we can start the conversations towards the content of the treaty. Just to be clear to all governments, the treaty does not exist. This is about creating a process that will give us the binding outcome where hopefully we can hold our leaders account. So with the Colombia, we applaud their leadership and we hope that other fossil fuel producing countries in the global south will also see that it's in their long-term interest not to continue their addiction to a poison, which is oil, coal and gas, that is killing our children and their children's futures.
And could you name names, talk about some of the nations and corporations that are profiting the most from fossil fuel extraction now, even while their words may say something differently?
Oh, that list, sadly, one is very long. So let me just say that there's double speak here, right? Because the thing is, we have won the argument, and we won the argument several years ago in the sense that not a single nation in the world says that the climate science is not urgent and real. Not a single fossil fuel company in the world denies the climate science as they were doing in the past and putting a lot of hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars in lies and misinformation, confusing people. Where the big difference is about the pace of the phase out. Fossil fuel companies and some of the governments that they dominate would like to drag it out, it would seem, right till the end of the century when the science says we are running out of time and we need to do it now. So the fight is for the urgency and the fastest withdrawal. And the most powerful nations in the world, Russia, China, United States, and so on, say one thing about the urgency, but in actual practice are actually nowhere near what the science tells us we need to do.
Kumi Naidoo, in a press briefing yesterday, you compared the fossil fuel industry with the industry of slavery. Explain.
So firstly, both industries were legal, right? The fossil fuel industry is legal. The slave industry was legal. Secondly, both are absolutely morally repugnant, right? Slavery was one of the worst atrocities committed by human beings on human beings. Fossil fuel addiction, its impact threatens the very existence of our children's future. So the scale of the immorality of our dependence on oil, coal, and gas, when we have alternatives and we can move decisively over the next decades to get off it. But the commonality is also that they have exceptional arrogance, they have exceptional both industries, they have exceptional control over political decision makers in several countries, and both industries behave with absolute impunity. Do you know that as we sit here today, slave owners in the UK still get compensation, their families still get compensation for the loss of their slaves, right? No compensation to the people under slavery, who suffered under slavery. So bottom line is both the industries are immoral, unethical, and so on. And we need to start treating the CEOs of fossil fuel companies as slave owners with the same kind of resistance that we saw to bring an end to slavery.
The COP, the UN Climate Summit, will be in Baku, Azerbaijan, yet another petro state. Last year it was the UAE. Can you talk about the significance of this and also talk about the role of the United States? We're in a historic election year. What difference what the U.S. does makes?
So firstly, you know, if the COP, which you and I have been to multiple times, didn't exist, we would have to create it. But let's be very clear that it's not the best, most equitable, most inclusive negotiating forum. One of the reasons we have had the term fossil fuels, which is the most direct impact on climate change, the most devastating impact kept off the agenda, is because consistently the largest delegations to the COPs is actually the fossil fuel industry. So if you take Glasgow, for example, UK, because it was in the UK, had about 300 delegates. When you combine the fossil fuel lobbyists, they are about 5,000. I mean, just try to imagine that. That is like Alcoholics Anonymous, an organization that does immensely good work and supports people around the world, having their national conference, and the largest delegation to that conference is the alcohol industry, right? The absurdity of it must be addressed. So then when you ask about the U.S., obviously in the U.S., we got a stark choice. You got the Republican Party, which basically in fact, it's about the only political party I know in the world right now that actually denies the science and whose leader actually, in a blatant way says, we're going to drive fossil fuel production, drill, baby, drill. So I guess it's not to say that the Democrats are anywhere near what we need them to be, because they say the right things, but we still see they are open to fossil fuel infrastructure being built and so on. So from an activism point of view, whoever gets elected, obviously the Democrats would be a easier fight for us, because while they're not where we need them to be, they are much closer to what we actually need from our politicians right now.
We only have like 30 seconds, but we just played a clip of Greta Thunberg, who was making the link between Chevron and Gaza. When she was just a climate activist, I wouldn't say just climate activist, she was covered all over the world and in the United States. In the United States, you almost never see her now talking about Gaza. You're South African. South Africa's brought that case to the International Court of Justice of genocide against Israel. Your quick comments linking the anti-war movement and the climate justice movement.
We have to recognize many of the struggles we face are very intersecting and very connected. The fact that Greta and other voices who see no contradiction between standing up against genocide on the one end and standing up for an ecocide that we are experiencing as a result of climate change, there shouldn't be a contradiction between the two. And it is sad that, in fact, the media environment, which in the United States, for example, claims to be democratic and open and so on, engages in such censorship around the contradictions that we exist. Because, you know, occupation in Ukraine is completely accepted. Occupation in Palestine is treated in completely different ways by the media, and that should change.
Kumi Naidoo, South African human rights and environmental justice activist, president of the Fossil Fuel Non-Proliferation Treaty Initiative. Next up, unless the U.S. Supreme Court intervenes, Missouri is set to kill Marcellus Williams tonight, despite the fact that the jurors, the prosecutor, and the murder victim's family all oppose his execution. Back in 15 seconds. By Susumu Yokota. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Unless the U.S. Supreme Court intervenes, the state of Missouri will kill Marcellus Williams at 6 p.m. Central Time today. On Monday, Republican Governor Mike Parson turned down Williams' bid for clemency, followed a short time later by the Missouri Supreme Court rejecting his latest legal challenge. Williams is African-American. He was convicted in 2001 of killing a former St. Louis Post-Dispatch reporter, Leisha Gale, who's white, during a robbery. He was convicted by 11 white jurors and one black juror after the prosecution was allowed to preemptively strike out six other prospective black jurors. Williams always maintained his innocence. The jurors, the prosecutor, and the murder victim's family all oppose Williams' execution. For more, we're joined in Kansas City, Missouri, by Tricia Rojo Bushnell, Marcellus Williams' attorney, executive director of the Midwest Innocence Project. Welcome to Democracy Now! We only have a few minutes, but it's possible that Marcellus Williams only has a few hours. Can you explain what you are calling for and what this case at the last minute is all about?
Yes, at this time, we're asking for what Marcellus Williams has been asking for 23 years, which is for a court to take a full and accurate review of the proceedings before it. Right now, for the first time ever, a few weeks ago, the prosecutor had to take the stand and testify under oath about his strikes that he used during the jury selection process. And at that hearing, he testified that he, at least in part, struck a juror based on his race. Yet right now, we have yet to have a court who will fully examine and review that evidence. We know that that's a violation of the Constitution. The prosecutor agrees that violated Williams' constitutional rights. But what we see is a system that's looking at finality over fairness, rushing to get to an execution date instead of taking the time to stop this execution and look at the merits of what is being argued.
And what was the main evidence against him? And could you talk about the advanced DNA testing and what it's revealed about the murder weapon?
Yes. So Mr. Williams was convicted based on what we know is a leading cause of wrongful conviction, which is essentially informant testimony. So this is a murder where there were no leads for months and months. And then at some point, the police suggested to the victim's husband that he should offer a reward. And it was only then, after a $10,000 reward had been offered, that the first informant came forward, a jailhouse informant, who said also that he wouldn't testify until he got the money. The information he provided was information that was essentially out in the public sphere from the newspaper, but he also provided information about another informant, a woman named Laura Asaro, who had had connections to Marcellus Williams in the past. She also not only had incentivized by the reward money, but the police forced her to talk by picking her up on her own warrants and saying, you know, we can arrest you and charge you with these crimes unless you help us here. At the time of the crime, there was a number of pieces of forensic evidence, including bloody footprints and hairs found at the crime scene, all of which exclude Marcellus Williams. In 2015, however, Mr. Williams requested additional DNA testing of the murder weapon, which was a knife found still protruding from the victim's body. That DNA testing was performed. Male DNA was found on that murder weapon, and it excludes Marcellus Williams. He is not the person who left that DNA on the knife. Based on all of that evidence, the prosecutor reviewed the case, brought forward this motion to overturn Mr. Williams' conviction on the basis of innocence, as well as on the basis of these constitutional violations, including racial discrimination. But on the day before the evidentiary hearing, new DNA testing came in that showed that the DNA on that knife could be consistent with the trial prosecutor's DNA and the trial prosecutor's investigator. At the evidentiary hearing, we've now learned that they mishandled that knife. They touched it without gloves in 2001 repeatedly, essentially destroying any potential probative value this critical evidence would have, which is what the prosecutor now also concedes was a constitutional violation.
So, Tricia, who is in charge at the U.S. Supreme Court of this case? What has to happen today?
So the stay motions go to Justice Kavanaugh, but the courts are going to be reviewing all of the cert petitions, the requests that the Supreme Court take on the case, as well as the motions to stop the execution. There are three petitions pending before the U.S. Supreme Court right now. The first is regarding the governor, Parson, had dissolved what was called a board of inquiry that was created to review all of this evidence. He dissolved it, even though Governor Eric Greitens had appointed it. So the first is regards to whether or not he was able to do that. The second is whether the federal courts should have reopened the case to allow this new evidence of racial discrimination in the jury selection to be heard. And the last one filed last night is about what weight should the prosecutor be given, his concessions be given, given. And we know that the U.S. Supreme Court has already granted review of a similar case, the case of Richard Glossop out of Oklahoma, where the attorney general said the same thing, that, you know, constitutional error occurred here and we shouldn't execute him. And so for those same reasons, the court should hear this case.
Tricia Rojo Bushnell, executive director of the Midwest Innocence Project, the prosecutor, the jurors and the victim's family have called for him not to be executed. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
Every Friday from 1 to 2 p.m., tune in to Department Uno to hear the latest and greatest from the CJSF playlist, featuring all new music from local, Canadian, and international artists. Fresh releases from the music department every week on Department Uno, only on CJSF 90.1 FM.